rural picture was given the thumbs up by the official Franciscus account last week. By remote privacy, too.
Today is Friday, November 20th, and you're listening to International Edition on The Voice of America. I'm Jason Patinkin in Washington. Coming up, Sweden abandons its hands-off approach to the pandemic.
It's been a very difficult time, and we have to look at other measures, and that's what the authorities are introducing now.
Also ahead, Armenia withdraws troops after a ceasefire with Azerbaijan over Nagorno-Karabakh.
These areas are civilian areas, and the people have in recent days fled the areas.
Plus, we hear from Senegalese people trying to reach Europe. These stories and more are next. Our top story today is in the European Union. The EU held a summit late Thursday over its budget and an aid package called Next Generation EU, meant to help European economies hit hard by the COVID-19 outbreak. But a dispute between Brussels and two of the EU's 27 members over human rights and the rule of law has held up approval with billions of euros at stake. For more, I spoke to journalist Catherine Field in Paris. Catherine, can you set us up here? What was this summit on Thursday evening all about?
The key point for Thursday's summit was to unlock this huge amount of funds, 750 billion euros, for countries whose economies have really struggled because of the COVID lockdowns and also the end of tourism in Europe. And it's really on that level that it seemed important, because there's no possibility yet of tourism or export markets picking up again. And it was really left to Ursula von der Leyen, president of the European Commission, to actually lay out how important it was to get this money distributed to the member countries.
And let's go ahead and listen to what von der Leyen had to say.
Indeed, we have a very serious situation now. People in Europe and the businesses, the companies in Europe are urgently waiting for the funding in this unprecedented crisis and deep recession coming from Next Generation EU. And indeed, now we sit down, we negotiate, we listen to what the issues are, we try to solve them. And again, I want to reiterate that Europe, in many, many very critical situations, in the very end, has found solutions to move forward.
Now, things did not go quite to plan. So far, there is no solution at hand. So what happens?
Essentially, anything that goes through the European Commission has to be approved by its parliament, the European Parliament. And back in July, when it was agreed that this fund would be set up, the European Parliament put in a clause which insisted that any funds that are transferred be conditional on adherence to democratic values, rule of law, human rights. And two countries in particular are falling short on that. And one of them is Hungary, which is accused of curbing academic freedom. It's accused of interference in the judiciary. And the other is Poland, which is already in breach of EU law by forcing judges into early retirement, thereby bringing into question the independence of the courts. So both of those countries, Hungary and Poland, which are desperately in need of this funds, have said no, they're not going to agree to this, because they say, we signed up to the EU all those years ago. There was none of this talk of rule of law. There were none of these strings attached. And if it comes to that, we will actually put a block on any of this fund being distributed, because under EU laws, those countries, all 27, have to agree for that money to be distributed.
So what does this mean? As you said, Hungary and Poland are struggling economically. They're certainly not immune to COVID-19. So what does this mean for economic relief in Europe, which has one of the worst COVID outbreaks on Earth?
This 750 billion euro package was indeed going to be a real lifeline to countries, particularly, let's look at Hungary. They were looking at possibly receiving as much as 40 billion euros. Poland was looking at receiving 130 billion euros. So they were really looking forward to this. Their economies are struggling. So It's now delayed. Other countries that needed it, not as much as these countries, but others need it, will also be struggling. What happens now is it goes back to the country that is president of the European Union at the moment, that's Germany, and German Chancellor Angela Merkel go back to these countries and say, look, this has got to be worked out. We've got to find some sort of solution. The only other solution that could come, given that so many countries within the bloc are really upset at how Hungary and Poland have been treating the rule of law in the country, they might just say, well, it's not worth the effort. Let's just go ahead and give it to the 25 member states that do abide by the rules of rule of law.
Now, there might be some potential optimism today. Hungary Prime Minister Viktor Orban told state TV that the talks should continue and that he thinks they will reach an agreement. Is he softening his stance?
Well, he does, of course, have a population that fully understands what's at stake here. Just look at some of the economic figures for Hungary. Hungary's GDP is projected to drop by as much as 10% this year. It's an economy that's heavily export-driven. So in lots of ways, he does have to try and sell this to his electorate. He might be being a bit optimistic and thinking that he can just push this through. But certainly, when you look in the past, German Chancellor Angela Merkel has always been a leader who has sought consensus, who sought for everyone around the table to come to some sort of agreement eventually. Whether they make it this time is difficult to see, really, again, because the European Parliament is so firm. They made it very clear they want independence of judiciary, they want human rights to be respected, they want democratic values to be respected. They've passed that vote and they're going to stand by it.
That's journalist Catherine Field in Paris. Catherine, thank you for joining us today.
Thank you.
The European region has had around 16 million total confirmed COVID-19 cases, with over 350,000 recorded deaths, according to the World Health Organization. One of the worst hit countries is Russia, which has recorded over 2 million total cases. On Friday, Russia reported a record high of 24,318 new infections, including nearly 7,000 in the capital, Moscow. Authorities also reported 461 coronavirus-related deaths in the past 24 hours, taking the official death toll to over 35,000. Also in Europe, we take a look at Sweden. Since the start of the pandemic, Sweden has refused to enact widely used public health measures such as lockdowns, strict limits on gatherings of people, or mandates to wear masks. But as a second wave of infections sweeps across the northern European nation, the Swedish government is changing its approach. Average daily cases have more than doubled in the past 3 weeks, while average daily deaths have gone up sixfold. Sweden announced this week it would limit gatherings to 8 people, and a ban begins today on alcohol sales in bars and restaurants after 10 p.m. The country is also considering further public health measures. For more on why Sweden is changing its approach to the outbreak, I reached out to Dr. Göran Hansen. He is a professor of cardiovascular research at the Karolinska Institute in Stockholm and the Secretary General of the Royal Swedish Academy of Sciences. Professor Hansen, first of all, what are these new changes that are taking place in Sweden?
The main difference is the limits on how many people can get together. It started with 500 in spring, then went down to 30, I think. And now we have 8. So it's a gradual change. I wouldn't say it's a dramatic reversal, but it's clearly stricter regulations and recommendations now.
And why is this happening? Because Sweden has been known as one of the few countries in the world that has not put in place many restrictions to try to control COVID-19.
Well, you know, Jason, we did very poorly in the first wave of the pandemic in spring. Not quite as bad as the UK and the US, but much worse than our neighbors, which are more comparable countries, Norway and Finland, 10 times higher death rates. And I think we were all shocked by that, but at least we thought that by keeping much of the society open, we would suffer less economically and we wouldn't have a second wave. That was the general thinking. I was skeptical to it, but many thought so. Now we have a second wave, and our economy was hurt to the same extent as our neighbors who had much fewer deaths. So it's been a very difficult time, and we have to look at other measures, and that's what the authorities are introducing now.
And do you think these new changes will be enough to bring Sweden's outbreak under control?
The most critical factor is whether people comply with the restrictions. And that probably requires quite a lot of information, and information targeted at groups with high-risk behavior. Furthermore, I don't think enough is done with regard to tracing exposure. And then I think we also need to look at those crowded places that exist after all. And when people get close to each other in the public transportation system, in the healthcare and so on, and introduce face masks there, and also make sure that we have maximal ventilation to get rid of the aerosol so that can contain the virus.
Now, many people around the world have pointed to Sweden as an example of how to control COVID-19 without the more restrictive public health measures. There are officials in parts of the U.S. who resist such measures, in Tanzania, in other countries, Brazil. Do you think there are lessons from Sweden's experience that could be applied to other places around the world?
I think there is a lesson to draw from comparing the Scandinavian countries. If you introduce strict regulations rapidly, introduce isolation measures and trace exposure and act on that, then you do better in the long-term perspective. Fewer people die, fewer people get severely ill, and the economy has a better chance because you don't have to keep the restrictions for as long as you have to if you go back and forth, like I think the UK has done, for instance, and the US. Sweden is not as exceptional in its strategy as one might think. It's been a slow response, too little at an early stage, and some peculiarities in the strategy. We paid for the mistakes made early on. Now it's an attempt to amend it. We've done poorly compared to our neighbors, not extremely bad compared to countries like the US or Belgium or Brazil, but it's not good enough, that's for sure.
That was Dr. Göran Hansen, professor of cardiovascular medicine at Karolinska Institute in Stockholm and the secretary general of the Royal Swedish Academy of Sciences. Dr. Hansen, thank you for speaking with us.
Okay, thanks, Jason.
The Americas have the largest COVID-19 outbreak on Earth, with over 24 million cases and nearly 700,000 deaths, the WHO says. Mexico has passed the 100,000 mark in COVID-19 deaths, becoming only the fourth country to do so, behind the United States, Brazil, and India. Johns Hopkins University reports the U.S. has had more than 11 million total confirmed cases and over 252,000 recorded deaths. Many Americans are pinning their hopes for an end to the outbreak on development of a vaccine. AP Washington correspondent Sagar Meghani has the latest.
The Trump administration says Pfizer and its German partner will seek emergency approval today from federal regulators for their coronavirus vaccine.
Hope and help are on the way.
Health and Human Services Chief Alex Azar says Pfizer and BioNTech will file today, with Moderna to follow in coming weeks. An independent board will review the applications and clinical trial data before the vaccines are approved. And Dr. Anthony Fauci says that should reassure Americans.
We need to put to rest any concept that this was rushed in an inappropriate way. This is really solid.
In his first White House briefing room appearance in months, Fauci echoed Azar in saying help is on the way, but again urged Americans to wear masks and avoid crowds as new virus cases surge. Sagar Meghani, Washington.
This is VOA. The Voice of America has called the southern U.S. state of Georgia for President-elect Joe Biden. Georgia is the last state for VOA to project a winner, bringing Joe Biden's final projected electoral vote count to 306, with President Donald Trump's at 232. 270 votes are needed to win. Biden also won the national popular balloting by about 6 million votes. Trump has yet to concede to Biden. As a result, Trump has kept Biden from seeing government intelligence about national security threats the country might be facing, or granting Biden aides access to a long list of government agencies. Trump is clinging to the long-shot hope that Republicans can overturn the results in a handful of battleground states that Biden won. A team of Trump campaign lawyers claimed Thursday there was a nationwide vote fraud, but produced no evidence to support their allegations. Listening to International Edition on the Voice of America. I'm Jason Patinkin in Washington. Azerbaijan's defense ministry says units of the Azerbaijani army have entered areas previously held by Armenian troops in accordance with a ceasefire agreement. The Russia-brokered agreement ended 6 weeks of heavy fighting that killed at least hundreds of people over the region of Nagorno-Karabakh. The truce says that Armenia must hand control of some areas it holds outside Nagorno-Karabakh to Azerbaijan, a process which begins today. Nagorno-Karabakh lies within Azerbaijan, but has been under the control of ethnic Armenian forces backed by Armenia since a separatist war in 1994. For more on the withdrawal of Armenian forces and how people on both sides of the conflict are reacting, I reached out to VOA Middle East correspondent Heather Murdock in Istanbul. Heather, thank you for joining us today. What's the latest with the Azerbaijani troops moving into these areas where the Armenians have withdrawn?
It's reported, and there's some videos out showing Azerbaijani soldiers moving into areas very recently held by Armenian forces. These areas are civilian areas, and the people have in recent days fled the areas, and the people who are living there. The idea is for these soldiers to come in, make sure there are no more troops, no mines, and allow Azerbaijani civilians who haven't lived there for the most part in about 30 years to move back in. It's also been reported that a lot of the homes and businesses have been burnt by the civilians fleeing. There's a lot of animosity between these two groups, and I can see why the people fleeing would feel the desire to burn their homes to not be able to share it with other people.
Now, Armenia handing land to Azerbaijan is part of the ceasefire that the two sides signed. But how are the Armenian people reacting to this agreement to hand lands to Azerbaijan?
In the country of Armenia, there is outrage across the country. Several high-level politicians and government officials have quit. There have been protests, and there has just been an outpouring of anger and calls for the prime minister to step down. Armenians I've talked to in the past couple of months have almost uniformly said that they view their control or their protection of Nagorno-Karabakh, they view that connection between Nagorno-Karabakh and Armenia, the severing of that connection, as an existential threat. They say that losing this land is threatening their existence as a people with a homeland. And it's almost difficult to exaggerate how emotional people are over this war. And it's also hard to imagine that people in Armenia will get over it and agree that this land has been returned to Azerbaijan and shall stay with Azerbaijan.
And what about the other side? How do the Azerbaijanis feel about this?
People in Azerbaijan are also very emotional about the issue. In the 90s, these areas, the residents were Azerbaijanis. Those people were all kicked out. There's no disputing this. There was a huge amounts of people displaced into Azerbaijan when Armenian forces took over the areas. By some estimates, given the amount of years that have passed, there's nearly a million people in Azerbaijan that are originally displaced from this region, Nagorno-Karabakh. So they view it as an area that is theirs, their homeland, and they're looking forward to going home. It's not that different when you talk to people as when you talk to Palestinians that generations later we'll show you keys to their houses. So it is very emotional for them, too.
That's Heather Murdock, VOA's Middle East correspondent in Istanbul. Heather, thank you for joining us.
Thank you.
A surge of migrants leaving Senegal for Europe in the last few weeks has left hundreds dead at sea and thousands stranded on the Spanish island of Gran Canaria. Soraya Ali of Reuters reports.
Migrants fleeing Senegal have been cramming into boats like this, hoping to cross 1,000 miles to reach Europe. Many of the boats don't make it. Sidi Guy was in one of them. His boat capsized in a collision with the Senegalese Coast Guard. Dozens are now missing, presumed dead. Now back in Senegal, survivors like Guy say they're haunted by the experience.
There were people who, after falling into the sea and raising their hands out of the water, they called for help. Once, twice, and after the third time, you couldn't see them anymore. At that point, you just have to take care of yourself in order to survive. You can't save them. And if you try to help, you could die.
Despite his trauma, Sidi says he has no choice but to try again. Around 17,000 migrants have arrived on Spain's Canary Islands this year, driven by the economic hardships of the pandemic. Spain's Interior Ministry says that's a 1,000% increase from 2019 and that its foreign minister will go to Senegal on November 21st to discuss the issue. Unlike the Mediterranean Sea route from Libya to southern Europe, the wooden fishing boats on the choppy Atlantic do not carry satellite phones, and so people cannot make distress calls. 55-year-old Aminata lost her son at sea last month. She says 24-year-old Mohammed was an onion farmer.
I miss him. When I look at this, I cry. He worked hard in the fields. He left behind an onion nursery. Insects destroyed everything. I called just yesterday, and I was told all the crops were destroyed. Maybe that's why he tried his luck.
22-year-old Abdulaziz paid $700 to get on the boat in October. He says he's lost hope of finding work in Senegal and will try to cross again.
What we really want is to stay here and succeed, work here and create jobs here. We have the potential, we have a little bit of training. We might need more training, perhaps. But unfortunately, it doesn't work like that with our government.
Spanish security forces said they will deploy at least three boats, a plane, a helicopter, and a submarine to slow the flow. However, it's not clear if that will cut departures from Senegal's long coastline, which is filled with thousands of identical-looking fishing boats, or if it will be a deterrent for those desperate to leave.
That was Reuters' Soraya Ali. That's it for our show today. I'm Jason Patinkin in Washington. Thank you for listening. Stay safe, stay healthy, and have a great weekend.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
The United States is committed to working with Pakistan in fighting the COVID-19 pandemic. As part of the ongoing partnership with Pakistan's National Disaster Management Authority, or NDMA, the United States, through the U.S. Agency for International Development, or USAID, in cooperation with the Punjab Specialized Healthcare and Medical Education Department, recently delivered 46 new ventilators to 13 hospitals in Punjab to meet the needs of Pakistanis suffering with COVID-19. This equipment is part of the 200 ventilators contributed to Pakistan by the United States. Deliveries of these ventilators were made through a partnership with NDMA and Chemonix, a U.S.-based international development firm. These compact and easily deployable ventilators will not only contribute to Pakistan's overall response to the COVID-19 outbreak by increasing the capacity of Punjab Health Department to provide advanced life support for critical patients in the province, but also help save precious lives beyond this pandemic, noted U.S. Consul General Catherine Rodriguez. We thank the NDMA, the Ministry of Health, and the Punjab Health Department for their dedicated support and leadership. The Pakistan-U.S. partnership is helping helping to improve and expand laboratory testing, disease monitoring, case tracking, infection prevention and control, and patient care across the country. The United States continues to partner with the government of Pakistan in its fight to defeat the novel coronavirus and safeguard its citizens, said USAID Mission Director Julie Conan. These ventilators are important tools in strengthening the capacity of local health facilities and their readiness to provide oxygen therapy and care to COVID patients in Pakistan. Working together with Pakistan's National Disaster Management Authority, the Ministry of Health, and local health authorities, our combined efforts will ease the